Hello, dear friends. Welcome to our show. I'm Greg Kokol. I'm glad you've joined me today. I'm actually not taking calls today at 855-243-9975. That's the number you can usually call during our live show. And that would be Tuesdays from 4 until 6. That's when we're broadcasting, and that's when we put together the podcasts, all of that. If you want to call, that's the time to call, generally. Not today, though, and I just want to talk a little bit with you and offer you some thoughts, and I have a feeling I'm going to touch on a couple of different things here, so it'll be a little potpourri of topics that I want to touch on briefly in this podcast, this broadcast, and basically, I know I'm going to be gone this summer, so I want to offer you something, even if it's a short time together, shorter than usual in our segments usually. This will probably be shorter, so that I'll have something to send to you and give to you when I'm out of town this summer. So I'm just going to kind of hit a couple of things that I've been thinking about for a while, and that may be helpful to you as you're thinking about these things. The first thing I want to talk about is going to at least initially sound like I'm going in a political direction, but I'm not, though it has, I think, political ramifications. I want to talk a little bit about the difference between the left and the right. And what I mean by that is progressives versus conservatives. Now, both those sets of terms are terms that are characteristically positioned regarding political issues, okay? But I'm not going to address any particular political issues. I've been kind of sitting back and watching for quite a while these two larger arenas and asking myself, what is it that animates these two, I don't want to say entirely polar opposites, but they tend to be the two ends of the thinking spectrum, because these distinctions here between progressives and conservatives, or the left and the right, are not just distinctions that inform political views and political sensibilities, but they inform a lot of things about life. In fact, I think that what these two represent is a different foundation of values that flow from how a person sees the world. And when you get involved in anything in the public sector, any policy issue, or any issue that affects large groups of people that you're campaigning for. That it's not all policy things. Policy issues are those issues where the government engages in legislation to inform or to coerce or influence certain types of behavior, where that's policy per se. But there's a lot of things that we do to influence public behavior that are not using the machinery of government to accomplish that. We're advocating for a certain side or a certain point of view, a system of values, or what's right or what's wrong, what reflects the public good or the common good, and how can we influence people. So it's a persuasive process a lot of times that we're involved in, certainly as followers of Christ, though, you know, we're involved voting and making a difference there. Our appeals are broader than that. And indeed, no matter where on the political spectrum or the philosophic spectrum of left and right we are, we're using a means of things, a different means, a variety of means, I guess is what I mean, to influence our world. So the question I want to address, though, is what is the difference between the left and the right? And what you could do is summarize particular positions that are characteristic of conservatives and particular opposing positions that are characteristic of the left. I say left here now and not liberal, because I think the distinctions are largely left and right philosophically. So-called liberal politics or liberal view on social issues can be taken in different ways. And I think it turns out that liberal sensibilities are largely informed by conservative values. Okay, right to free speech, for example, is a liberal cause. It isn't one that the left shares right now, but the right certainly does. And so this is, I think, I'm just going to talk here not about the right versus liberals, because I think that's confusing. Just the right versus left, and I characterize the left as progressives. So if you don't think this captures all of the concerns, that's all right. I want to give you some ways of understanding these distinctions that I think are helpful for us as followers of Christ, because I think there's a dynamic here that relates to Christianity and the Christian worldview and our convictions about making a difference or having an influence as ambassadors for Christ. So the distinctions I'm drawing here are going to be left-right distinctions, or, as I put it a moment ago, conservative or progressive distinctions, all right, as opposed to conservative versus liberal. Now, the thing that's, I think, characteristically when people think of these camps, they think of the particular views that are held by them, and so you'll say the conservatives are pro-life and say the left is pro-abortion, okay? And so we distinguish these camps by a list of views that they hold. But I think that there is an underlying animus, something else that is driving those particular views, okay? Why is it that the political left lines up with this particular set of views, and the political right lines up with a different and opposing set? And that's what I want to address, because I wasn't sure how to answer this. And I've listened to different people who have offered distinctions between these groups, and they have just listed the different points of view. But what is behind it? And something occurred to me that I want to pass on, and you may not agree with it. It's fine. But I think there's some insight here, okay? And when you think about the terms themselves, it gives us a hint. Progressivism is the term that the left uses to describe itself. They are progressives. It's a you know, honorable sounding term, and I mean it's a way of describing the view that sounds laudable, and I'm not taking exception with that. It's just that the left perceives that its direction is moving ahead into the future, where conservatives are trying to conserve, all right? They are trying to, by some perspective, they're reactionary. They're going back to the past. I think this is actually a great way of understanding the distinctions. The political left or the sociological left admires change, and almost for change's sake. If there's a change, it is in order to leave the past and move towards the future, and that is presumed to be a good thing. Conservatives, though, want to conserve the past because of the, I'm just going to call it the wisdom of the ages. So now I'm getting into an assessment here. I think the value of being a conservative is that there is a history that we draw from, where, there are lots of things that need change. The question is whether the change that is applied to the foibles or difficulties or liabilities of the present are going to be informed, I should put it this way, the question is what set of principles are going to inform them? I am a conservative, broadly construed, and the reason that I am a conservative is because I think that we have learned something as a not just as a culture, but as a human community over the eons that we have been practicing life. And my sense is that the best of conservatism is meant to conserve the wisdom of the past and not venture into new areas too quickly because we may be short-sighted, myopic in the way we move forward and might act without considering the long-term consequences, okay? So let me give you an illustration of this. I was speaking at a high school, a Christian high school, about 2 months ago in North Carolina. And I was asked a question that I think the audience expected a different answer than I gave. And the answer that I gave actually just occurred to me in a flash of insight. I don't know that I've talked about this a lot prior to that. But the question was, here are high school students that are Christians in a position to move on to the next stage of life and move on to the university. And so what would you suggest, Mr. Kokel, about the kinds of challenges they're going to face? And I suspect they were thinking about what kind of ideological challenge will these students, as young Christians going into university, face that maybe as an apologist I might be able to help prepare them for. And what occurred to me is that the biggest challenge that they're going to face is not ideological. I mean, not at least at first. It's not going to feel that way. And it has ideological elements to it, but there is something else that is a factor that is almost never discussed when we think about the challenges of the university environment to high school students who are Christians. We talk a lot about the ideas that are corrosive, and there's plenty there. But here's what I told them. I said the biggest challenge that they're going to face is sex. Now, there's a lot involved in that, and I began to explain that. It's not just the sexual behavior. When you're young, especially if you're a young man, there's all kinds of physical intensity going on. And I just look back at my own adolescence and emerging adulthood. One of the reasons that I left the fairly modest religious upbringing that I had in the mid to late 60s was when I left it, getting out of high school in 1968 and going to university, first the Army and then off to different schools, all on my own, is that, boy, when you're 18, 19, 20, the hormones are raging, you don't want religion to spoil the party. And so I didn't let it, and it was easy to abandon it. But see, this is part of the problem. When you're a follower of Christ in high school, in a youth group, you have your parents around, you have your pastor around, you have your youth group leader around, you have all your friends around, and you're meeting once or twice a week and for special events and lots of things. You have a great support environment to keep you on the straight and narrow. But when you go to the university, that changes radically. Now, you might be thinking, well, I'm going to a Christian school. Well, that may be better, but not necessarily as good as you think. Because now there's not anybody looking over your shoulder like before, and you have the freedom, you have the latitude, the liberty to do the kind of things that you would not have been able to get away with before. And so this is going to test the Christian's mettle, but it's more than that. It's not just an environment where liberty is made possible. It is an environment where sexual liberties are encouraged that you take. Or you're encouraged to take sexual liberties. Because this is what we do. This is our value. This is where we're at. We're at college, university, and all kinds of ideological elements are there to encourage the young people. This is why it's really important that committed Christians find a group of other committed Christians when they move from one group of committed Christians in their community out to another community. You got to find the body of Christ to help you stand tall. That's just wisdom. Okay. But what is the appeal, apart, what is the ideological kind of argument that is offered to entice people with more conservative sexual values to embrace a more libertine lifestyle when it comes to sex? And I think it's largely the minimalist ethic. This minimal ethic that we hold people to, that we can do whatever we want as long as it doesn't hurt anybody. And so the appeal is, gee, I'm not hurting anybody. I can do what I want as long as I don't hurt anybody. And how is me having sex with consenting adults going to hurt somebody? Now, here is where I think the difference of conservatives and progressives really comes into play here. Think about it. Of course, the conservative view is that sex is, and it sounds almost quaint to say it this way, but it is reserved for marriage. You don't have sex until you get married is the simple way of putting the rule, but it doesn't really capture the sense of the ethic, which is sex is such a powerful thing that you want it only in the protected environment of a long-term committed relationship. When I say long-term, I mean marriage. I don't mean just, we're really close and we really love each other and I can't envision ever breaking up with my boyfriend or girlfriend, so then sex is okay. No, I mean this, the totally square, conventional deal. Well, we're progressive. We're moving past this. This was my idea back in the 60s. We don't need that old style stuff. It's no fun. And what the heck? Who am I hurting? Now, of course, the problem of this progressive view that we are progressing out of that ethic into an advanced ethic where we can experience the enjoyment that was denied us because of this medieval sexual ethic. And in fact, I'm not hurting anybody. Well, that's the big benefit. I can have the fun and there's all upside, no downside. As if tonight's pleasure isn't going to hurt anybody tomorrow. And you're probably right. That is, tonight's pleasure will not hurt anybody tomorrow. But what about 3 weeks from now, 6 months from now, 10 years from now? That's the real question. And I explained to the young people there at that meeting where I was speaking is, you have no idea of the consequences of your behaviors in the long term. You have no idea what is going to hurt somebody down the line because you don't, and this is not a fault of yours, you're just young, you don't know how life works. Your parents know more about how life works, and that's why they tell you to do things or not to do things that don't make any sense to you, because they understand more of the long-term consequences of behaviors than the culture who have lived out these ethics over time know how these behaviors influence masses of people over longer periods of time. So my concern about progressivism is it doesn't have the long view. It's a desire to change what we've been doing for a long time, to try something new, because it sounds better in the moment, but there's no history to fall back on to know its long-term consequences. during the same-sex marriage debate a few years ago in the Supreme Court. One of the justices said, you know, maybe we should move a little bit more slowly on this issue because the concept of same-sex marriage is not even as old as the cell phone. So maybe we shouldn't be too quick to overhaul the foundations of society. And that's exactly what same-sex marriage has done, since cultures are built on the family unit and marriage makes a family unit. And so therefore, tampering with the definition of marriage tampers with the understanding and the definition and the basic structure of family, which ultimately has a consequence for culture. What is that consequence? Well, you know, when you start changing things willy-nilly, it's hard to know. That's the problem with progressivism, per se. Let's just leave the past behind and embrace something new. The value of conservatism is there's a history. There's a desire to conserve the values that have been tried over the course of time and have proven themselves to be wise. You know, it says in Proverbs, and I read this not too long ago, it says that the glory of young men is their strength. I mean, young people have vigor. Good. That's great. I'm aware that I'm losing a lot of that. You get older, you just get more broken down. Things cease to function like they used to. You can't do what you used to do. All right? Young people can do it. They have strength. But they don't have what? They don't have wisdom. The glory of young men is their strength. What is the glory of old men? The glory of old men is their gray hair. That's the way the Proverbs puts it. What does that represent? Wisdom. Wisdom. Old men have been around for a while. They are not just energy undirected. They are in a position to take the energy of youth and direct it in a profitable and wise and sound direction. And see, this is what I think is the fundamental mistake of progressivism. It is an impulse to move away from the values of the past, especially when those values are in the moment inconvenient, and embrace a whole new set of values. Let's just reinvent the wheel. Let's start all over. Let's make a new thing, and it's novel, and it's new, and it's progressive, and it sounds forward-thinking. The problem is it does not have the wisdom of the ages behind it. It has the strength of youth, but not the gray hair of the old men and old women. Okay? And so there's one other aspect of this that I want to emphasize before we take a quick break, and that is that the values of conservatism, that is, the past that has shown itself to be sound, are largely grounded in a Christian worldview, because Western civilization has been grounded in a Christian worldview, a Judeo-Christian understanding of reality. And this is especially true of the United States of America. It's also true of Western Europe, but they've moved more quickly away from those, conserving those values, to progressing into new things. And I think it's just caused them trouble. And we see the same trend in this country. Let's move forward and progress. And sometimes that is done too quickly because it's a knee-jerk reaction against a worldview that has shown itself to be sound as it governs the affairs of human life. And because I'm committed to reality, which is reflected by God's revelation of the nature of the world and is reinforced or corroborated by our own assessment, as we observe the way the world actually works, when we spend time to do that instead of just jumping, taking a leap of faith into a progressive future, then we realize that the things that God says about the world really are sound. And this is why, you know, if you don't have sex until you're married and you only have sex with the person you're married to, this creates an unbelievable amount of stability in the home, and it's healthier for the kids in the long run. And this is a strong family unit that creates a stronger foundation for culture, and the benefits flow from that. We start tossing this stuff willy-nilly because we want to progress. We want to move forward instead of being those, you know, stick-in-the-mud conservatives. Well, then we're taking our chances. So I just want you to think about that distinction. Progressives want to move forward. They want to leave the past behind. I think that's foolish because the past represents the wisdom of human beings who have lived life through all the ups and downs so that they know what hurts people in terms of our behavior and what doesn't. And because of that, certain conservative values have been formulated, many by experience, many by scriptural revelation, plus the experience of seeing those things bear fruit when lived out, so that they protect us from the foolishness of just jumping into the future. Anyway, that's the distinction that I see between progressives and conservatives. I think this is the dynamic that now informs the particular points of views that conservatives have and progressives have. And it also gives you an understanding why I want to stick with the wisdom of the ages, and I'm not quick to change the whole system thinking everything's going to be rosy. We've been down many of these roads before, and we know what happens when we ignore the wisdom of the ages. Okay, something to think about. Let's take a quick break, and I've got a couple more things to run by you on this kind of special commentary-focused show. Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
The Bible's under attack. Its claims about history, science, and morality are all being challenged by some of the toughest atheists in the world. That's why I'm thrilled to tell you about this year's Rethink Apologetics Student Conference. Our theme this year is Has God Spoken? And we've invited some of the top Christian apologists to respond. Speakers like J. Warner Wallace, Frank Turek, and Jason Jimenez, as well as a host of others, will help you rethink how you see the Bible. So join us in Orange County, California, at Calvary Chapel Costa Mesa on September 28th and 29th, and find out why we're convinced God has spoken and why that changes everything. Be sure to visit rethinkapologetics.com for more information. Register today. We'll see you there.
You can connect with STR on social media to keep up to date on all the latest, including articles, videos, events, and giveaways. You'll easily find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Interact with STR staff, post comments, get involved with other like-minded Christians, weigh in by responding to some of the issues of the day, and see what's going on behind the scenes. Social media is your gateway to all the latest from STR, including speaking events, new podcasts, resources, articles, and what's on our mind today. Follow STR online and find all our social media platforms when you visit str.org and click Connect at the bottom of the page.
All right, Greg Kokel back at you here, Stand to Reason. And I want to touch on two more things quickly, and then we'll call it a day for this segment. But that have come up on a fairly regular basis. Actually, not too long ago, I had two questions that were very similar, and touch on what I think is one of the most difficult theological challenges to us, and that is, how is it if we are fallen, and we are born fallen, and therefore we cannot not sin, and that's standard Christian theology. How is it then that we can be held responsible for that which we could not help but do? And I think that it's difficult because there was a ethical intuition that we have, and that intuition is that, simply put, ought implies can. Ought implies can. In other words, I can't be expected to do something that I cannot actually accomplish. I can't be held morally responsible for something that I could not do or maybe didn't mean to do. In order to be held responsible, I have to intend it, and I have to have been in a position where I could have done otherwise. I could have not done it, kind of thing. Now, I think that is a very natural moral intuition, and I think it does inform our reactions to other people and our people we know and children, et cetera, et cetera. We just don't hold them responsible if they don't seem like they can be responsible. So I'm not taking exception with the intuition at this point. I think it's a functional value that plays a role in our moral decision-making. However, I'm pretty much convinced that it's not a biblical value or dictum or principle. What the principle ought implies can is not biblical, right? For one, the fact of the matter is, though it sounds like a conundrum or inappropriate, unfair, whatever, however you want to characterize it, the fact is we are held responsible for our crimes against God, even though we, in a certain sense, since we're born in sin, we can't do otherwise. Now, I don't mean we can't do otherwise with any individual sin kind of thing, but given the broad spectrum, we can't live a sinless life because we are sinners. And our rebellion against God flows from our nature, and we're held responsible for that. And I frankly don't think that's just a straightforward teaching of Scripture. And I have never heard anyone give a sound theological justification to the contrary, but I'll make things more difficult for you. The book of Numbers, as one example, I think there are more in Leviticus, etc., but I was just reading Numbers recently, so it's fresh in my mind, has provisions for sacrifices for sins of the people that were not done intentionally. Huh? Right, they're called presumptuous sins. In fact, there's a lot of detail about sacrifices for unintentional sins. Why are there sacrifices for unintentional sins if they can't be sins if they're unintentional? The answer is, even though they're unintentional, according to God, that's my read on this right now, they still are sins. They still are sins. So we are born into sin and therefore into rebellion, and we make conscious, willful decisions in virtue of our fallen nature to rebel against God, for which we are responsible. And we also do things that we didn't even realize we're doing them, but they're still wrong, they're still offense to God, and we're responsible for them too. Now, I don't want people to get all bent out of shape here and start looking over their shoulders wondering, what's God going to zap me for next? Because this is the magnificence of grace, is that it covers everything. What Jesus did covers everything. But I do want to narrow down a little bit. And, you know, maybe I'm misunderstanding here. And one of you, if you think I am, you can call me sometime and give me a piece of your mind. But it sounds to me, as I look at these passages, that it is not the case biblically that ought implies can. And even sins that were done, in a certain sense, the way we would put it, innocently, are not innocent before God and require sacrifice to expiate, which means that we're in a pretty tough spot. We're in a spot where we... we're really lost, is kind of my point. Now, I've talked in the past about the idea that we could be responsible for the evil that we do, even though we're doing it by our nature, by giving illustration out of the Lord of the Rings and the second book and the Uruk-hai that were created by their evil master, Sauron, to work evil on his behest, and they were still evil and deserved to be killed, even though they were born evil. And Amy Hall made a suggestion to me, offered an insight along this line I had never thought about before. Does God choose good from a neutral position such that his good choices are noble because he is neutral and from the neutrality chooses the good? The answer is no. God chooses the good because his nature is good and he is praiseworthy, not simply because he does good things, but because he is good. So God gets the credit, in a certain sense, or the honor for goodness, though goodness is innate to him. That it's innate to him doesn't take away from the goodness, and that our fallenness is now, after the fall, innate to us does not take away from the badness. That was her point. And I think that's another angle here that helps us to understand this. So it's a, you know, hard teaching, but seems to me to be the biblical one. Last thought here, and that has to do with who created God. And this is a point, a question, a challenge that comes up much more often than it should from people who should know better. All kinds of PhDs and academics raise this challenge against the cosmological argument. The fact that the universe came into existence implies a cause that brought it into existence that is outside of the natural world, since the natural world is the effect, and therefore there has to be a cause that is either supernatural or supranatural, however you construe that. And so in any event, that's the death knell for naturalism as a metaphysical view, or physicalism, or materialism, okay? And the rejoinder then is, instead of addressing the problem proper, people say, well, then who calls God? You believe in God. We believe in the universe. You are forcing this dilemma on us, so we're going to turn the dilemma on and stick you with it. Now, there are lots of problems with this. Here's one way of approaching it. You know the question, are you still beating your wife? Of course, the problem with that question is it's called a complex question, which means there is a presumption in place that the question assumes, such that if you answer the question itself, you are affirming the presumption before it. No, I'm not still beating my wife, but I used to. Yes, I am still beating my wife, so I am now. In either way, you're a wife beater. And that's why it's an illicit question the way it's posed. So here's the question with regards to who created God. What is the assumption behind that question? What are you assuming when you ask who created God? You're assuming, of course, that God was created. Okay? And then you ask, who was it? I had this question. I knew it was going to come up in my national TV, or rather radio debate with Michael Shermer. And Michael said, who created God? There you go. And I was ready for it. And I said, Michael, you don't believe God was created because you don't believe in God. I don't believe God was created because I believe God was eternal. Nobody in this conversation believes that God was created. So why are you asking me who created him? You get the point. There is nothing about our view that requires us to answer that question. And it is not in the least wise inconsistent. The universe came into existence. Virtually everyone agrees to that. Big Bang cosmology. The universe was not eternal. There's lots of good arguments, scientific and philosophic, why that cannot be the case. If it came into existence, the odds are that something or someone caused it. There was a cause to account for the effect of the universe coming into existence. God is not the kind of being who came into existence, and so asking what caused the coming into existence of God is the wrong question to ask about God. So not only is it fallacious as a complex question, it is also fallacious as a category error. If God is eternal, then we don't need to answer that question because it doesn't apply to us, and there is nothing unusual, inconsistent, or irrational about saying God is an eternal being. He's the ground of existence itself. Aseity, A-S-E-S-A-I-T-Y. He is self-existing. But we know the universe is not self-existing, and so that's why the question, what caused the universe, is an appropriate question, whereas what caused God is not an appropriate question. It's very straightforward, and for some reason, I think I know it in many cases, people keep asking the question. In many cases, it's asked by people who ought to know better, and they do know better, but the general public does not know better, and so it has great rhetorical force with them, even though it's dishonest, irrational, and disingenuous. There you go. So there's my judgment on that question, and I hope those thoughts will help you to answer that in the future. That's all I have for you today. I've really enjoyed chatting with you a little bit, and I hope you've enjoyed this mini show here. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven this week. Bye-bye now.